Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about different types of water you can put in your spray tank, a continuation of our conversation last week. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at Case debuting the new Stars and Stripes Magnum tractor. In our Ag History Minute, we'll be talking about the history of reverse osmosis water. Cool Beans, that's Corny. We'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. All right.
You ready for this one, Matt?
Let's just rock into this.
Like continuations?
It's been raining, so might as well go into it.
The cliffhangers that we left on last week of talking about some of the different options, now we're going to give you some satisfaction. We're going to go right into it. So what do you got, Todd?
So we talked last week of testing your water. So that is the step one test. Step two is...
steel underpants?
If you tested...
Oh, sorry, this isn't the underpants gnomes from South Park?
No.
Step four is profit.
Step three is profit.
Oh, three? Ooh, yeah. I already
said three steps.
Collect.
Collect profit. Underpants. Don't know. Profit.
Well, let's go to the profit step.
Yes, profit is good.
All right. So now that you know you tested, if your water is good, you're good. You don't even have to... just skip over to the...
Right to profit,
and you can go right to the spotlight today. Don't even worry about this part. No.
What speed is that?
I don't know.
4X?
I think...
how fast can you listen?
Podcast, I think, is like 3X, isn't it?
It's up to that now?
I think it's half, one, one and a half, two, maybe two. Maybe it's two.
We definitely got to do an episode where we talk extra fast. Then
or extra slow.
Then speedy. Yes. Ooh, or extra slow.
The water is ready.
You sound like the Dory from
Dory. I speak whale.
So if your water comes back and it is poor, so this is for water tests, high test poorly, bad pH, like we talked last week, any of that stuff, then the next step is, what are your options? What can you do to mitigate the water you do have or find a different source? So then the second step would be, how much water do you use? So I think you do have to quantify that number, because to go on to the third step and to try to pick out which source, you got to know how much water you are using. And this actually varied kind of a lot, because some of our listeners have the co-op spray, so then I'd be talking to them or figuring that out. But if you're a co-op listening and you have to spray, like, think how much water they go through in a year is crazy. And hopefully where they're sourcing their water is
a 1 million gallons.
Yes, it'd be a lot. It'd be a significant amount. But if you spray your own, that could vary a lot too. That if you're, say you spray 2,000 acres a year, and spray acres isn't always the same amount as your total acres either. That is one, say you're spraying soybeans twice.
Yep.
Corn once or maybe twice. Maybe you don't have to spray your alfalfa at all or just the new seeding. But this is your spray acres. This isn't like take your total acres.
Man, you're spraying times, corn maybe three times.
In true.
Some cases
right.
With fungicide or whatever else.
Right. So this is your amount you spray. And the other thing to think about is when you're going to need this water. So if you're doing pre-emerge, you need it at a certain time in May.
If you're doing a plane or a drone, though, you might use less.
Oh, nice.
True. Yes. Drone, you might. Yes, good point, Matt. So I'm just going to use 2,000 for easy math. Obviously, at 10 gallons per acre, that's easy. It's 20,000 gallons you're going to need. At 15 gallons per acre, it's 30,000. And at 20 gallons per acre, you'd be at 40,000 gallons. So that amount is significant, but it's not so much that you can't pay attention and maybe do something different with the water at that amount. But if you jump down to, like, say, 10,000 plus acres, then at 15 gallons per acre, you're at 150,000 gallons. That amount gets harder to just have on hand in a tank or a separate way, or maybe, or just...
Got an old manure pit?
Right.
Fill her up.
Right. Well, and we'll get into that, is you also want to keep this... Obviously, if you're using a different source, you still want it to be very good, clean water. So you know, that
pool liner in your manure pit.
Ooh, so that yes. You can fill it. But when you sprayed, was that just well water they put in a tank? And then
it was well water from the ground.
But, and that would pump out fast enough? That
yeah, we had a well a
big old...
I think then it was a 2, maybe a 3-inch hose at the most.
So just...
Just rocking the fire hose.
They didn't have tanks. It was straight out the...
Straight out the well and...
Straight out.
Was it... Did you guys ever test that water?
No.
No, it was just go.
No.
It was just, this is what we got.
Well, and those were the days of when Roundup actually worked. So it was... I mean...
It would have worked better
like
if you...
I sprayed dual Hornet. That was our pre-program, and we did all of it pre-plan incorporate. That was... 99, 2000 in that time frame.
Just dual Hornet.
Dual Hornet. That was the whole season. And then like beans, it was one shot of Roundup and AMS. That's all we did. There was no surfactant. You just
we had the AMS in there.
That you just relied on the surfactant in the Roundup, and you did your AMS, and off you went.
Yep. All right. So in today's world, we want to, as we talked last week, we're throwing more in the tank. You tested your water. Now you looked at how much you need. And again, depending how much you need, is maybe which avenue will work best for you.
Is this where we get out the dousing rod and find the water?
The what is it?
The dousing rod. You ever seen the people that take like a stick and try to find water? It's called.
You got a local guy that does that.
Got a dousing rod.
Oh yeah, the thing you use to find tile lines, kind of a deal.
Yeah, I guess you could use it for that too. If there's water, if there's no water in the tile,
then it won't work.
I don't think it would work. But.
Okay. So I've got options for you guys, and I'm going to have you guys kind of weigh in on these options while we're talking about it, and then maybe at the end, too, you can say. And they're in order of, like, cost, actually, of what's the cheapest option to what would be the most expensive option. And that goes back to how many gallons you need. That if you don't need that many gallons, then maybe you could go to a higher cost option right away, or some of these... Because of the cheaper ones are easy to do, that you can store that many gallons more easily, that those might work. The other part with this is there is not a lot of research on this. So I do want to preface this by saying, like, I don't work with any growers that really use, all my growers use well water right now. So in the research out there, depending by the state, it was quite different. A lot of it, if you live in a state that you do have hard water, that tend to pop up more. Like parts of Texas must have really hard water, parts of Nebraska, obviously Wisconsin, but certain states seem to like have a little bit more. And I wouldn't even call it, like I said, research. It's just that, like we said, step one was testing. There's a lot of research on that, but these sort of alternative sources of water are fairly new, fairly just not necessarily researched enough to know what direction's right, but it's something to think about on your farm. So first cheapest one is collect it from the sky. So rainwater, find a way to
just leave
collect,
the
yeah,
top to, of the tank open and
yeah, right.
Let her fill.
Let her, yeah, like that. You might not catch it up. But yes, rainwater. So rainwater is an excellent for mixing with corn or bean herbicides because it's generally free of dissolved minerals. So no calcium, magnesium, which can neutralize, like we've talked about in the past, glyphosate. So it's soft water, and it's got to be free of debris. So that's very, very important. Like we can't have any, you know, say you're collecting it off a shingled roof. You don't want any of the grit from the shingles in there. If you're even just, they were saying like, say you collect it off a steel roof, but you get just sort of little particles of dirt, collect on the steel roof, wash down.
Bird poop.
Right. So you either do have to like screen it or filter it in some way when you're pumping it out.
It is bonkers how much grit from your shingles
comes. Yes, it is nuts. Yeah, yeah. So this would work. Bill found a good chart on hard water, and that would make sense. It shows very hard water, like northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin. It's interesting that the part we live is just hard water.
Well, we're moderately hard.
Yeah, moderately. There you go. That's even less hard. And you kind of swing down to kind of the western states and down, or where it's very, very hard water. So you go to the southeast part of the United States, so Georgia, Florida. And again, I didn't see any articles from Georgia or Florida, so that makes sense.
Sure.
That they weren't on there, or North Carolina. So it was mainly more of like a Midwest to southeastern states. South,
yeah. Southwest, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this one, so Egg Talk user FarmerBoy50 from Texas posted, "I catch soft water off my barn. I could tell the difference in well water and rainwater when he sprays. I haven't cut the rate back on any herbicides, but it sure makes the chemical more effective with zero additives of any kind. Don't know that RO would be cost effective, but if you have a guttered barn and a couple tanks, you're in business." So I think that kind of sums it up too. If you have some tanks laying around that you're not using, you have, you know, obviously have a way to collect it, like gutters. And just the simple math, a 40 by 80 shed. Would you guys say a 40 by 80 is, I mean, used to be the most common shed? No, that's probably small.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just using a 40 by 80. So, I'm sure you got bigger. If you had an inch of rain from a rainstorm, you'd get about 1,800 gallons from that collected. So, again, if you're in that, you need 20,000 gallons to spray, that may or may not work well at the time you need it. Or not, but at least if you got...
You're going to get that over a year.
Correct. But so you can't. How are you going to collect it and use it? But one good part, typically, you know, April showers bring May flowers. So you hopefully collect those. April showers would be a start. Or I don't... Again, I don't know. It depends on your size and how you're going to do that. But one of the downsides with rainwater is if you don't get the rain to fill your tanks... You may just have to pull from your well anyway, or
2012 would have been tough.
Right.
Just pile your snow up on the hill.
And yeah, let it
the melt as it comes down.
The like
your own little mountain snow melt.
Yep. The one thing to think about with catching rainwater would be that you probably, like on a pre-emerge herbicide, you probably could just use your well water. And then on contact herbicides, glyphosate or any sort of contact, then use the rainwater. So it could be the other way. If you know, okay, I'm not going to have enough rainwater for the whole spring season, I'm going to kind of push it towards herbicides that I need that more. Would you guys agree with that too? Pre-emerge isn't probably going to matter quite as much, and you could use well water for that. So maybe this too, this is not
the rainwater anyway to get it worked in. Get
right,
it moving.
Right. You're just relying on it to activate.
Right.
Not so much the contact part, like you said, is the
but deal. This would be a spot where maybe you could decide when to use it. Not you don't necessarily have to exclusively use it all the time. So the next one that kind of is in the same mold would be surface water. So there is farmers using surface water, meaning chucking a pump into a creek or some of them are kind of using springs, they would say. So like this one would be a little easier that you're not going to run out like rainwater typically. I mean, the creek might be lower, but this one you do have to really watch. So farmers using surface water should be aware of water turbidity. So like the suspended solids and some of the stuff in there can like even get so bad where you're going to clog your nozzles. So not only, and then the other part will bind herbicides. So any sort of just murkiness to it or...
Right. Again, if you can filter it somehow, it would be better. Yeah.
Right. And a settling tank, they said, and then pumps and filters. So same kind of option. I don't think, like in Wisconsin, this wouldn't would be quite as easy. I mean, for certain farmers, maybe, if you're right by a, by a certain type
of... Live close enough to a plant where they're pushing off already cleaned water, it might be a better option to collect it from them. Because they're just putting it back in the creek anyway, so.
We have talked, that was a talk, if you are, it's not going to get in here, but if you are by something that discharges clean water, that.
What if you're a big farm with a digester
and
you figured out
right
how to
make it clean, but
discharge that water.
Right. And maybe, too, it might not even be clean enough to discharge. It may be clean enough to spray with.
Land apply, yeah.
So the next one jumps into kind of a, this one I would say is an easy one, but the most is just add a water conditioner. So next more cost. So those first ones was just get a couple tanks, pump off the water just sort of free from the sky. The next one you do have to buy a product. And this to me is what we've been doing forever now is the most reliable way to add water conditioner, which is like ammonium sulfate. And this will tie up those minerals rather than relying on sort of other waters. And most of these products, one thing you got to think about of what they're doing is any product you add in the tank that is by volume is probably in there to treat the water.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's, you know, say it's a herbicide, you know,
7 pounds per 100 gallons.
Right. So if you're at those rates, then it's there to treat the water, obviously, and you really got to watch that. And I think we're even guilty of, it used to, like you said, Bill, when you sprayed, it was all dry AMS, I'm mm-hmm. sure.
It was.
And then we kind of switched to these liquids, and these liquids can work good, but if you have very hard water, you may have to use an extremely high, especially the highest rate on that label. Because there's also ranges, typically, that it's 7.5 to 15 pounds per 100 gallons. Well, that's a big range.
Right. Which gets that. Back to the testing part of, right. If you've tested your water, you hopefully have an idea of how bad, in finger quotes here, bad your water is.
Yep.
And that can inform you on what part of that range you should be operating in.
So after that, the next most expensive is using softened water. So softened water is generally better than hard water for herbicide applications because it reduces the mineral content of it. However, you are substituting those minerals, so calcium, magnesium, you're substituting them typically with sodium, or if you're using like potassium chloride, you're substituting them with potassium potentially or the chloride. So the depending what you're using for your salt and how your water softener is set up, you still could cause reduced herbicide efficacy if the sodium interferes, but I would say typically that's going to be better option than hard water.
Yep. And there, here it just gets back to the volume thing is the more salt and, you know, the more gallons you're running through a softener, the more salt and other things you're going to make. So that it's going to add to your cost. And, you know, if you're lower gallons, it's probably not going to be that bad of a, or big of a deal, but the more gallons you're getting, the higher the cost of some of the additives are going to be.
And the last two are the easiest ones that we're doing, right? Like,
right.
And the stuff kind of we're already doing to some
degree, correct.
Right? Where most of us have water softeners, whether that's for our homes or
right.
at the farm.
So we're used to using them. It's right. just, are they on the scale of, are you using that for your spray water? I do have some guys using softened water for spray water, and it does work good. You got to watch regen cycles on that because you probably are blowing through.
Very fast.
Yes. Having more of that, having regen more often and then keeping up with salt, like Matt's saying, too, can be, so you're going to have costs that way. But it typically, when I looked at this one, it was cheaper than the next option. It still was
sure.
fairly sort of reasonable in a way to kind of pull some of those out. So this one, too, you're going to want to make sure you test after the water softener to see how, probably before and after, just to see where you started and then
right, see what okay, kind of improvement.
Where did we go? Yeah. And even that, most even residential water softener guys do that. They test it to know which setting. I know my water softener set at like a 30. I don't know what that even means, but he tests it. It's like you got to be at a 30 for your setting to make sure it softens enough. Next option, as I said, we're getting a little more expensive, is reverse osmosis. So putting in a reverse osmosis system or purchasing water that's RO water. And this can be a very high quality source because it's for sure removing the calcium magnesium and it's not going to be putting back anything else. You're removing that. And this one, I wouldn't say it's, we don't know yet if, I would call this the Cadillac just because we're using a very pure water then. There's just a lot less to it. It's kind of pulling out really all the things that can be a problem. And this one could be, but it, this one's quite expensive, and it does use a lot of water as well. So the amount of, like, if you put in an RO system, you got a very high equipment cost and then a higher maintenance cost too. So you don't have salt and stuff, but you have specialized membranes that need to be replaced.
Insane and then, in the membrane. Insane.
That's an oldie.
It is.
It just sounds cool. RO.
RO does. It RO sounds like water. You're, yeah.
I feel like that's something that somebody would be advertising that humans should drink to be.
Well, it is.
Yeah, a lot of drinking water, like that's their whole selling point of the system is supposedly improves your drinking water. Again, finger quotes, because I think there's a debate of whether some mineral in the water is good for you versus having none. Because unlike the softening side, you're not tying up things, you're removing them completely.
Right, now you're going to need to get your minerals from somewhere else besides water. So, yes. And one of the things I didn't realize is how inefficient these systems can be. So, basically, for every 1 gallon of water you get, of RO water you have at the end, you have to use 2 to 4 gallons of water get wasted. So, have to get diverted somewhere in your system. And so if you're pumping it out of the well and then you've got this other water, you're not going to want to water your cattle with that extra water. You're going to have to find a spot of how to use that extra water.
Just another mineral like you got to put out there for the cattle.
Right. Maybe there's
took it out of the water.
So there is a process that it can be inefficient, but it's not like you're paying for the water either that you're pumping out. And depending on how much spray water you use, you could still get enough really good water out of that using RO. There is other ways to get, like, team up with an industrial source of RO water. One that I didn't realize was like a car wash, that most car washes for that, like, spot free rinse, when you get really, that.
I suppose.
Yeah. Actually, just in a car wash, and my son asked me, like, what's the spot free rinse? Like, thinking it's just some sort of fake, but you could tell the water beads up different. And,
yeah, I always thought it was more of a particulate size, correct, of the droplet kind of thing.
But, and this was, it just said most car washes. I'm sure there's different.
Did you roll down the window and, like,
try to drink it? Yeah, just collect
the RO water.
You could spray with it.
Some. Yeah, did you go with your truck? Or did you just open the bed up and, like, line it?
Fill the.
Derek can use it catch for the all his soap water.
Yeah, you'll get the soap and everything else too.
But another Egg Talk user, Evil Lanky Me, posted, "We use RO water and are able to cut our rates and some chemicals because of it. One of our landlords owns a car wash and he has a giant RO machine, so we get it at a reasonable price." So, maybe put up a car wash in your neighboring town and then you can.
Well, I wonder too, because you said with the RO system, you're diverting some of that water, if they can just recycle that for other parts of the wash.
Sure, maybe they use that in the rest of the wash, and then, I don't know if that goes down the drain.
Saying car washes are cheap, but
they are not.
You'd think that they'd be even more expensive than they are if it costs them 2 to 4 gallons every gallon they use on your car.
It isn't cheap to go to the car wash.
No.
I mean, it's quick and easy, and you don't have to scrub your car, but
what do you guys think of these new, like, club car wash and some of these where you pay a subscription now to?
I've seen that, yeah. My kids always want to. There's a new one in Appleton across from Costco. It's the Monkey Wash. They always want me to drive over there and go through the Monkey Wash. It's all different lights and stuff.
Yeah, okay.
But it's really surprising to me how many car washes have popped up over the last, five years.
And this new model of this.
Yeah. Well, Quick Trip is railing them in every, well, not every, but a lot of their stores. Do you do the soft touch or the
no touch? No touchy.
I've done both, and yes, I had more problem in the soft touch.
Have you?
Because one time it flung, like, you know that part in your truck, like the molding by the, this is my old truck, but it, like, somehow knocked the black molding off of the window, and then luckily it knocked it to, like, this hallway, and I kind of walked in there and grabbed it, but.
Yeah, you probably get a better scrub. Like, just the water only wash where right. you don't, there's no touch, like you get bugs or that kind of thing. That
right, it never seems really come to get off.
It doesn't feel yeah. soft when that beater is flipping on your mirror.
Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel like your paint job's.
No. But I still do the soft touch.
Yeah. I always pictured you as a soft touch, Bill.
Okay.
Anyway.
So we start off by saying there wasn't a lot of research in all this. They did find one, Beck's, one of their PFR studies, that they basically sprayed RO water and just well water on two things they used. One of them was a fungicide, and then the other was like a, so one was Valtima at R1, and one was Versamax AC at V4 on corn, which Versamax AC, I wasn't familiar with that, but that's basically like a micronutrient kind of pack. And then their thing with this was basically that was the only thing different, and then they went to yield on it to see, and then factored in the cost as well of what adding this reverse osmosis system would be and adding the cost of that. So their sort of observations was that if you have very hard water, that this could be a good thing. So they start off by saying we did not see consistent results with reverse osmosis water study. However, our Minnesota PFR site, which typically has very hard water, has seen a consistent response. So again, back to mats, test your water. If you have very hard water, like this Minnesota site did, you will probably see more of a response.
Yeah, it looks like mostly southwestern Minnesota is in the very hard water category, according to Bill's map.
But they did a spot at central Illinois, and they had sort of not a return on investment, if that makes sense. And then same with Ohio. There wasn't a return on investment for the RO. But in the Minnesota, all of it, it was a return on the RO side, or, you know, it helped.
Sure.
Steam does especially help on the micronutrient a little bit more, but it varied. So it didn't. It wasn't like a...
Sorry, I thought you said steam.
I did too, Todd.
So I was like, oh, they steamed it?
No, they did. Yeah,
steam. Because that would be another way of potentially improving your water is condensing it. I don't know. Did you look into that process, Todd?
Distilling and then...
Distilling your water, yes.
I think that might be expensive.
Tea kettle?
There you go. Just...
Well, the one thing with the... you mentioned like watering cattle and stuff. Because this is where they lay out, you know, so if you're doing 20,000 gallons of water at 2 to 4 gallons of actual processed water, you're really putting 40,000 to 80,000 gallons of water through the system. Maybe if you can water your cattle off the...
You would not want to water your cattle off the residual, though.
Residual, though? No, it's that
bad. You probably would not.
Okay.
Probably not. I mean, that... Yeah, I don't know how you could set that system up, but...
Yeah, no, I was curious, I don't know what it looks like. I've never had an RO system, so I don't know what it...
There's some farmers talking about watering their cattle with RO water, with the...
Sure.
With the good stuff.
Good and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just because, either again, you...
So water your neighbor's cattle with...
Yes.
or the cattle you don't really like, the one...
So the last two options here are a little different. That was kind of the lineup of least expensive to most expensive. Then you got sort of other things that I hear out there. One would be just a totally different source. So like city water, or like we said before, maybe there's some sort of industrial process near you that they have extra water at the end that would be clean enough RO water. But city water is a choice that I've heard of some spray guys or co-ops that they use the city water because they can use the high cap well, and they've got a you know, they might use kind of, I know one where the fire station has a higher gallons per minute pump that they can, or not a pump, but pipe, and
just crack open a fire hydrant.
Yeah, they're basically using.
I was just going to say that basically. That happens.
Yeah,
there's some co-ops that are using fire hydrants in certain townships to do that.
And this might be something where you're probably going to pick the closest, but you might want to test these neighboring cities or sources and see which one is the best for spraying. and then see too what their chlorination levels are. What I did see in general, that standard municipal chlorination levels, so the amount of chlorine or chloride are in there, typically is too low to really hurt the herbicides in the tank. It's not going to be enough. I mean, it's enough in there to maybe obviously like clean the water so that people don't get sick on it, but it's not typically enough to be a problem. But you, that is something to think about with that, that not only could you be getting really hard water if it's well water, and then you also got chlorination on top of it. Some cities can have RO water, but depends on the area. That I, most do not. So
it seems like it would be too expensive to.
It depends on the city and where they're getting their water from.
Just for the capacity of
right, but there was a fair
amount. I'm sure there's some that do, but
right, there was more than I thought, but it was still a fairly low amount. That there's a chance your city near you has it, but probably not.
So and you're then saying there's a chance,
and then the one we're gonna kind of end on that I still, there's just not a lot of research on, and we hear this more, is called structured water. Have you guys heard this or know?
Yeah, I've heard some presentations on it. There was was at the National No-Till Convention a few weeks ago, and they had like a, I think I talked about this in the podcast, the Shark Tank like thing, and one of the up and coming people that was trying to promote or, you know, sell their idea was a company that did structured water.
Pulling out of a shark tank?
And they called it,
yeah.
It's got shark poop in it. So much better. Ooh. That's the structure.
No. Cures cancer and sprays your crops.
No, something about the resonance and the frequency of the water, which I know I always thought water was water, but apparently it's not just two H's and an O. Sometimes it can be more than that.
Three H's and two O's?
Yes. So, and it can be energized or magnetized or like vortexing or magnet devices to like to structure this water. And it tends to kind of lower surface tension in the water, higher oxygen content, and then it's said to be more easily absorbed by plants. Like it's sort of like making water wetter is
sure
some of the claims. So
increasing plant uptake.
Yes. So we're going to go like kind of two sides of the coin here. So what the proponents of it say is reduce surface tension, so you're going to get better foliar absorption. And basically it's also, increases the solubility. So you're going to better dissolve herbicides or whatever you add into it.
That's
potentially
cool.
And
get your herbicides mixed in faster too. Yeah, you know, like in the solution.
It potentially, yeah. But these are all sort of claims. I would say that there, right. I found like no research that showed like you say, Bill, like, mixing up Kool-Aid. It wasn't like, yep, we could mix this faster with this water versus the other.
Well, and this next one, though, is the one that I've also heard in tandem with structured water, is that you can reduce your rates.
Right. So they're claiming 10 to 50% reduction in rates, which would be great. But if that isn't, you know, I've seen herbicides where you reduce the rate and you may or may not see just, again, there's no study that showed the reduced rate with unstructured water. We need more research on that to really sort of kind of prove. And I think this one's going to be a harder one to prove because, again, it may matter on what you're starting with for water as well. So if you have really poor water to start with, this potentially is going to help somebody that starts with good water.
Well, and the one system, the guy had some pictures, and some of it looked like it was like an RO mixed with because this system that the guy was showing had I can't remember what he called it, but basically it looked like it was going through like a water softener or RO system or something along those lines, and then there was this other pipe that improved the resonance of the water, so that was your magnets or your crystals or whatever.
Was he drinking the water at the end or not?
He did not have the system
going
physically there. He couldn't just.
He was drinking the Kool-Aid. He just
he took a shot of atrazine, but he did not drink the water. No.
Roundup.
Right. So I said what the proponents would say, but so the people kind of, maybe not against it, but that are kind
skeptical.
Right. The skeptics are saying, here's the sort of scientific realities that it lacks rigorous data, so we just need more data on it. And then water hardness is key. So if you got poor water, it's going to be different than if you have good water. And it shouldn't make it, like, if you're already using the right adjuvant load, that probably works better anyway than to structure the water and sort of use less adjuvants or something like that. And then the last one that I think is key here, but there's no herbicide labels that say if you're using structured water, here's the rate. This would be going off label potentially if you're reducing it by the 10 or 15%. So,
right. You're probably just guessing to start with.
Right.
So don't go right to the 50%.
Do some field trials.
So those are, so back to that. Yeah. To wrap it up here is surface water, rainwater. You can use water conditioners. You probably should anyway. Softened water and RO water are kind of some options to explore if when you test your water and it comes back real poor of maybe an avenue. And all of these can be good or bad options depending on your farm.
Right. Thank you, Todd. So, yeah, test your water. Just see where you're at to start. And there's probably options to make your water better. So not that you have to run out and find new water, but it's probably good to manage it in some way. So now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So in honor of the country's 250th anniversary, we've got the Case IH debut of the Stars and Stripes Magnum Tractor at the 2026 National Farm Machinery Show. Decked out in red, white, and blue colors, Case's special edition Stars and Stripes Magnum Tractor glittered at the farm show in Louisville, Kentucky to honor the 250th anniversary of the United States. We wanted to reflect the qualities of American farmers, their enduring spirit, and their ability to go out and always get the job done no matter what the conditions are, according to Jay Barth, Case IH's high horsepower marketing manager. Of course, that spirit is part of America's heritage. Case IH also rolled out its latest additions to the Farmall family, built for comfortable versatility. The brand's new compact series of tractors aims to deliver power from sunup to sundown with the 35A and 40A tractors. So lots of new things coming out of Case IH, and it does not say how many Stars and Stripes tractors there are, or if you can even buy that paint job, or what?
It really doesn't say at all, and that was like, because it's super cool looking, like the
even the
these like, special editions, and then the way they kind
of the edge of the rims is red,
yeah,
like kind of to tie into the whole thing. So yeah,
it's just a cool looking tractor all around that you wonder how many they made, what they did. They were talking about in so at the 200th year, so 50 years ago. Case also made a special edition Case tractor, and that they did 200 of that special edition and sold those. So that was kind of neat. Where this one, like you say, we'll see if they're going to make a bunch, if they're going to be for sale, or if this is just more of a showpiece.
But yeah, either way, looks cool. So now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So on the subject of water, we're going to talk the history of reverse osmosis water. So the process of osmosis through semi-permeable membranes was first observed in laboratory setting by French clergyman and physicist Jean-Antoine Nollet in 1748. He used a pig's bladder as a semi-permeable membrane to show that water could selectively pass into a flask of alcohol, causing it to swell. 1959, UCLA scientists Sidney Loeb and Srinivasa Sorajan developed the first functional asymmetric RO membrane using cellulose acetate. This was a turning point because it allowed water to move through the process much more efficiently than previous methods. In the 1960s and 70s, the U.S. government invested heavily in RO research for wastewater recycling in spaceships and to provide drinking water for military submarines. Cape Coral, Florida in 1977 became the first U.S. municipality to use RO on a large scale. As their population grew, they built the world's largest low-pressure RO plant in 1985. RO is used in the dairy industry to produce whey protein powders and concentrate milk. The whey, which is the liquid remaining after cheese manufacture, is concentrated with RO from 6% solids to 10 to 20% solids before the ultrafiltration processing. The retinate can then be used to make whey powders and whey protein isolate. Maple syrup producers also use RO to remove water from sap before boiling the sap to syrup. RO allows about 75 to 90% of the water to be removed, reducing energy consumption and exposure of the syrup to high temperatures. So, lots of different ways you can use RO.
Yeah, pretty neat. Thanks, Matt. Thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. We've made it really easy for you. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts, or you can also download an app like Podcast Addict or Spotify, and you can there too search Tilth Talk Radio. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthegg.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now it's time to get into our cool beans that's corny and some current events. So cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans. Cool beans. Our cool beans this week. CoBank projects a 6% jump in U.S. soybean acres for 2026. They're forecasting that increase because of even with slim margins, they expect many producers to head into the soybean acres, or adding another 5 million acres to the existing soybean acres from last year. So 86 million total acres is the anticipation, which is a far cry from last year where we were sitting at 81 million acres. The reason is we are so aggressive with our numbers. There are so many more marketing opportunities heading into 2026 versus what was available last year. He also said the projected corn acreage of 94 million is nearly 5% below 2025, and he also sees soybeans pulling away from wheat acres this year as well. So there might be a little bit better look at the market for this next year, and that's reason to be happy, hopefully, if you grow soybeans. Our That's Corny this week. Ranchers are on alert as wildfires are spreading across the Plain States. High winds and low humidity are expected to continue throughout the week as producers deal with multiple fires that have blazed across western Oklahoma, western Kansas, and the Texas Panhandle. So, more than 300,000 acres have burned across Oklahoma since Tuesday. The Stevens Fire that started east of Hooker, Oklahoma, has burned at least 12,000 acres as of Thursday morning and is 50% contained, so lots of activity there. I did see in the news a lot of issues with getting, you know, those areas are big grazing areas where you have large open fields with fences and the cattle are getting pinned against fences with the fires. So they're trying to move them around and lots of potential for herd or lots of risk to an already small beef herd
right
in that part of the country. So
that's just terrible. Wildfires can be hit and like the animals wouldn't, they'd be kind of helpless around that.
Right.
So some of the proponents were saying the GPS new style, like collared fences, that's sure. An advantage to those is one,
right, just move them. Just tell them.
Well, kind of, yeah.
Fence isn't there anymore.
Yeah. Right. And basically, yeah, you can obviously track them down after. And typically one of the problems after wildfires is all your fence posts are gone, or not all of them, but they're severely damaged typically. And I mean, I remember, I don't know, Bill, how many times you had to put up fence, but just a couple times.
Oh, putting up fence posts too. So,
oh, and it was a lot. Just putting up a good fence is a lot of work. So that hopefully that new technology could potentially help people that are getting ravaged by these fires.
Yeah, the Oklahoma Cattlemen's Foundation has established a fire relief fund to support cattle producers that have been affected, so you can check that out and donate if you feel so inclined. But yeah, Kansas, Texas, lots of different kind of issues. It looks like crust. Kansas, there's a number of fires as well. So 4 active in Texas. Yeah, it's just kind of a mess out there right now, and hopefully they can get them under control and get back to business as usual. All right, now we'll wrap things up with our Feel Good Friday. Secretary Rollins has announced $263 million in food purchase money to support U.S. producers and strengthen America's food supply. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins today announced that the U.S. Department of Agriculture's USDA intent is to purchase up to $263 million in dairy and agricultural products from American farmers and producers to distribute to food banks and nutrition assistance programs across the country. These purchases will be made through USDA's authority under Section 32 of the Agricultural Act of 1935 and will assist producers and communities in need. With this action, the Trump administration is bolstering American prosperity by supporting American agriculture, rural communities, and those in need of nutrition assistance. So they're looking at kind of a breakdown of $75 million worth of butter, $32.5 million worth of cheddar cheese and cheese products. Swiss cheese is $10 million. Fresh fluid milk, $20.5 million. Ultra-high temperature milk, $10 million. Chickpeas, $12 million. Dry beans, $25 million. Fresh pears, $15 million. Lentils, $14 million. Pecans, or pecans, depending on
pecans.
Where you live.
Pecans.
$10 million. Split peas. Make a lot of soup for $24 million worth of split peas. And walnuts, about $15 million worth of those as well. So pretty diverse group of products, not just dairy products, but also some fruits and vegetables in there. So can make some...
Yeah, that many pears.
Pecan pies.
Fresh pears, not apples, not any other orchard fruit, but pears.
Yeah, must be downturn in the pear market, pears, I guess. Yeah. Don't follow that one as closely as other ones. But yeah, so good news there. And with that, we'll wrap up this episode. So thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So today we talked about your water options when it comes to moving beyond maybe just your regular groundwater or well water, and ways to improve it for your spray tank. In our spotlight, we took a look at the debut of the Stars and Stripes Case IH Magnum Tractor. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of reverse osmosis water. Cool beans this week is the expected jump in soybean acres for 2026. Our That's Corny this week was wildfires that are currently spreading across the Plain States. And our Feel Good Friday was the announcement of $263 million worth of food purchases to help support and strengthen agriculture. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.